KGST Fresno 1600 AM.
El siguiente es un programa pagado por el anunciante y 1600 AM no se hace responsable por las opiniones reflejadas en su contenido.
This is a special program on Multicultural 1600 AM, so please stay tuned.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Welcome to All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlo Dermogradichian. I want to welcome all of the listeners in the valley here and throughout the world that are listening. We just had Armenian Christmas last week, and people were celebrating Armenian Christmas on January 5th and 6th, and of course the New Year. And now we're kind of moving forward in January, and just a little bit about what's happening out at Fresno State. Classes begin this Friday, which is the 17th of January. Kind of odd to start on a Friday, but that's when it's beginning. And then Monday will be a holiday for Martin Luther King. It'll be an observed holiday, and the university will be closed. But then classes will begin again on Tuesday, the 21st, and then we'll start our semester, which will run all the way through May. And we'll be talking a little bit later today about some of the activities and some of the programs of the Armenian Studies program. Today, I'm happy to have with me my guest is Mimi Malayan. Mimi Malayan is the executive producer of a film that has been going throughout the United States and actually throughout the world, based on the life of Diana Opkar. And the name of the movie is The Stateless Diplomat, Diana Opkar's Heroic Life. Mimi, it's really nice to have you with us today.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Yeah, we're going to be talking today in about different aspects of the life of this very extraordinary woman, Diana Opkar, who her granddaughter, great-granddaughter, that's Mimi, was fortunate enough to be able to explore and to research, and then was able to produce a movie. So Mimi, I just want to start with the basics. Tell us a little bit about who Diana Opkar was.
Well, Diana Opkar was one of the diasporan Armenians who grew up in India. Born in 1859 in Rangoon, Burma, which was part of the Indian British Empire. She lived in Rangoon and then in Calcutta, where she went to convent school. When she married, when at the age of almost 30, she then, after her marriage, moved to Japan with her husband and her oldest daughter, Sirvart, or Rose, as she was known, my grandmother, to Yokohama. Japan had just opened up to the West. They had been closed for over 200 years, and in the Meiji era had a policy of inviting Westerners to Japan. And Michael Opkar saw an opportunity to expand his business. And Diana lived in Japan the rest of her life. So she was there from 1890 until her death in 1937. She had five children, two of whom died, and then her husband died in 1906. She was always interested in writing and wrote a novel as a young woman, and then wrote a series of short stories during the Japanese-Russo War of 1904-1905. And after the Adana massacres in Armenia, she refocused her energy, her writings, her research, her interest to the Armenian cause. So starting in 1909 was when she really committed herself to Armenia and the Armenian cause. Her husband had died 3 years earlier. Suddenly, she had had to learn to take over the business and support her family. But as her son grew up and was able to take on more responsibility of the business, it gave her more time to commit to her writings and her research, her interest in helping Armenia and the Armenian people. So she was a very religious woman, and she was really motivated spiritually to work for Armenia and the Armenian population. And she believed that she could deter or call attention to what she foresaw, which was basically more massacres to come. So starting in 1910, she wrote feverishly. I mean, just in 1910, she published two short books, Betrayed Armenia and The Truth About the Armenian Massacres. Now, what she's talking about when she says, when I say Armenian massacres, is the Adana massacres. So the genocide hasn't happened, but she foresees the genocide. And she talks about the determination of the Turkish government to finish the Armenians, to complete the extermination. She uses all of these words in the years preceding the genocide, and it's an obsession of hers. She can't let go, and she's determined to contact anyone who will listen to her. She wrote dozens of articles. She's written hundreds of letters to prominent peace societies, to politicians, to religious leaders, anyone she could gain contact to, she would write and advocate for the Armenian cause. But then, of course, there, as we all know, the genocide took place. The great powers, they played their games. They, of course, were striving, only considering their own interests. And then the Armenians suffered terribly. But what happened after that, completely unexpectedly, is that Armenians escaping the genocide, survivors of the genocide, actually traveled north into Russia, and because of the Trans-Siberian Railway, which had been completed at the end of the 18th century, provided a route of escape for these people. And if you had a modest amount of money, you could ride the Trans-Siberian Railway east across Siberia to the Pacific Ocean. And it was a 6-month journey, or for some it took longer because they didn't have the full funds to pay their way. So they would get off and work and get back on. But the rail was an assured way of at least escaping more persecution. They didn't really know where they were going in some cases, but others, I believe, like your grandfather, Barlow,
yes,
had a very clear sense of how to escape the of where he was traveling. And once they reached Vladivostok, they could go to Japan, but only with the proper documents. And so after the genocide, starting in 1916, mostly the biggest waves came in 17, 18, and 19, Diana took on a different role of supporting the refugees who were stranded in Vladivostok, because the majority of them did not have documentation. They did not have passports, and in order to reach Japan, they needed a proper visa. And Japan did not have an asylum policy in 1917, and so Diana's role became critical. She was respected by Japanese officials and gained their they acknowledged her willingness to do whatever she could. She guaranteed for the refugees who wanted to come to Japan, because basically Japan was the only route to the U.S. There were no major ships coming out of Vladivostok. You had to go through Japan. And her guarantees is what enabled the refugees to come to Japan and then take the next step to the final leg of their journey to come to the U.S. And so Diana provided guarantees to the Japanese government. They allowed the refugees access, and while they were in Japan, which could have been a several month stay, she supported them however she could, with housing, with food. She would find them jobs, and then help them find their relatives in the United States who would guarantee for them to enable them to then come to the U.S., because they needed that support. They needed some type of connection to the U.S. to make that final journey. There were people who had no connection to the U.S., and in that situation, for example, she wrote to the Secretary of Defense or to the Secretary of State arguing that she had a group of 25 or 35 young men who wanted to come to the U.S. to serve in the U.S. military. And she argued that they would make exemplary citizens, because any country that was willing to show kindness toward them would guarantee their loyalty. They would guarantee their loyalty to that country. So she tried whatever she could, even finding friends who would try to support someone to come if there was no direct relative. And she would, find their passage and process their papers and basically enable that journey.
Well, this is, this is a woman that we think about that story that you're telling about her, and it's extraordinary, but it's even more extraordinary, isn't it? Because at that period in the early 20th century, for a woman to take that role, especially after the loss of her husband, was pretty remarkable, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I don't know what to say. You know, people have asked me, was she a feminist? And in many ways, she certainly acted as a feminist. She believed that you did what you had to do. But yet, she was a very proper Victorian woman. You know, mm-hmm. everything had to be done very properly. Every image I have of her, her dress goes from the bottom of her chin to her ankles, and from, you know, her arms are completely covered, and, you know, everything is very conservative in so many ways. But on this score, in defense of her people, she was willing to cross all boundaries. I mean, similarly, in defense of her family, as she became a businesswoman, she was willing to cross any boundary.
Would you say that came out of her faith and her devotion to the church? I mean, what was the real motivating factor, and based on your research?
There's no question her faith played an absolutely critical role. And she writes about it in the book named In His Name, in which she talks about a vision she had, in which, or a calling, I should say, that she got from God. And the Armenian cause was her mission. There's just no question about it. And in fact, just before the genocide, when World War I starts, Diana has a nervous breakdown. And one would think that she would have the nervous breakdown after the genocide started, but it was actually before, because she was so consumed with this vision, with these images that she kept seeing repeatedly in this a dream of hers, where she foresaw the genocide, she felt the frustration of her own failure, her failure in preventing this. So she took it on very personally and felt responsible in many ways, and had a mental collapse at that point. And it took her several months to recover, but then she took, you know, her missions and put her back into action.
Really the culminating kind of part of this career, and we're going to talk more about it, was her appointment as the honorary consul to Japan, because Armenia had become an independent republic in 1918, and in 1920 she was appointed to this honorary consulship, which I believe was the first time a woman had taken on such a position. Is that right?
Well, that's disputed. Mm-hmm. I've looked into that, and there was, for example, a Hungarian woman who was appointed ambassador to Hungary, ambassador to Switzerland from Hungary, Rosinka. Oh, I've forgotten her name. But at the time, there were newspaper articles that talked about Diana as being the first woman diplomat. And so that's kind of where the story comes from, that in fact it was promoted back in 1920 that she was the first woman diplomat. But I actually take that, her appointment, as almost inconsequential. I think of all of her achievements, that is the least of her achievements. It's certainly wonderful to be acknowledged and recognized and receive that honor. But given the scope of her work before her appointment and after her appointment, what continued basically throughout her life. Her work far exceeded what I would consider the role of any diplomat or ambassador representing Armenia.
Right.
So
yeah, let's hold on, and we're going to talk a little bit more after our break. This is All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlow Dermergedichian. My guest today is Mimi Malayan. We're talking about the life of an extraordinary woman, Diana Opkar. We're going to take a pause and then come back and talk a little bit about the movie that Mimi produced. So we'll be back in just a few minutes.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Thank you.
Tune in to All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Over the break, we were listening to a song called Pari Luso, Good Morning, which was performed by an Armenian folk rock band called Bampir. Bampir was formed in 1978 in Gyumri. That's a town in northern Armenia. And they've gained quite a bit of acknowledgement and recognition in Armenia and abroad. They've performed in many different countries, in Armenia, in Georgia, Russia, the United States, and they include in their repertoire Armenian folk songs, modern arrangements of Gomidas and medieval Armenian music. And we'll be listening to some more of the music of Bampir in just a few minutes. My guest today is Mimi Malayan. She is the great-granddaughter of Diana Opkar. And in the first segment of today's program, we were listening and discussing the life of Diana Opkar. Mimi Malayan, however, is the executive producer of a movie that is about the life of Diana Opkar, called The Stateless Diplomat, Diana Opkar's Heroic Life. And just last semester, in October, Mimi presented that film here at Fresno State, and it was really an outstanding documentary. Mimi, tell us a little bit about at what point in your own life did you become aware of your great-grandmother, and then what set you on the path to the vision to have to make a movie about her life?
Well, growing up as a child, I always heard about her. I knew that she had a prominent position in Japan. I knew that she had been appointed consul representing Armenia in Japan. But that was about the extent of what I knew. And it was really, everyone in my family always talked of Diana with great respect, but there wasn't a lot of substance behind it. There were family stories about a certain recipe that she liked, or perhaps that she was very superstitious, but there wasn't archival material. There wasn't a lot of factual information that would enable me to really understand the full scope of what she accomplished. And it wasn't until actually my uncle, Lionel Galston, passed away, and I was cleaning out his apartment, and this was in 2002, and I found a box of materials that he had labeled Diana Opkar in his closet. And included in the box were her books and an unpublished manuscript, a few letters, not a lot of material, but it reintroduced her to me in my as a mature adult. And I was still working at the time and didn't have a lot of free time to commit to looking into her. But it was kind of, the seed was planted in my head that there was something here, and that at some point I would need to pursue it. And out of that box, actually, my mother's cousin, Lucille Opkar, she typed up and self-published a series of short stories that Diana had written that had never been published. And the book was called Book of a Thousand Tales. And it was a series of short stories basically stories that the genocide survivors had told her when they came through Japan, and she wrote them down. And anyway, Lucille published that book in 2004. And that same year, Ara Gazarian from the Armenian Cultural Foundation in Arlington, Massachusetts, assembled a few belongings from different family members of Diana and created an exhibit at the ACF location and invited Lucille with her book. And so the idea kept growing in my head. And when I retired, 10 years later, I decided to put more, to put my own energy into the project. And I started researching her, and there were two main archives that I accessed, both at Stanford University. One was her 15-year correspondence with David Starr Jordan, who was president of Stanford University. And the other archive at the Hoover Institute was the American Red Cross of Vladivostok archive, where she represented the Armenian population. And so both of those archives provided a lot of background, a lot of information into Diana's story. Similarly, around the same time, I was introduced via email and Skype to Melanie Masropian, a young Armenian woman who actually moved to Japan to study linguistics, but then ended up changing her focus to studying Diana Apkar. And only last May completed her PhD on Japan's response to refugees during World War I, with a focus on Diana Apkar and the Armenian population. And so Melanie accessed the Japanese archives, where, for example, Diana's guarantees were located, where Diana would write to different officials requesting that certain people be given access to Japan, that she guaranteed for their any costs that they may incur or whatever their necessities while they were in Japan. And so the combination of these resources gave me just provided a lot of background. And I, at some point, I decided that just doing research was not sufficient, that I needed to share her story. And I thought very briefly about trying to write a book, but I thought that a film would be the most effective way to reach as many people as possible. And so around, I guess it was 2012 or so, was when I first started the idea of turning this history into a film.
And you had quite a few obstacles or challenges, I guess, because if you think about a film, we always think of it in a very obviously visual format. And I don't know, were there very many photographs, or were there any videos at all of Diana, or things that you could use?
That's an excellent question. Of course, there was very little material. I mean, one reason was in 1923, her house collapsed during the Great Kanto earthquake, and all of her whatever letters or materials she had were lost, and personal belongings as well. But additionally, you know, that having even photographs at that time were rather a special affair. So no, there was very little visual material, and that was why the film has a series of animated scenes that tell Diana's story and the story of the refugees who traveled east. And this was actually the idea of my co-director, Artur Maradian, to do line drawings, which are all done in Photoshop and then animated, but done in a way that is very similar to Japanese graphic novel storytelling. The Japanese have a 1,000-year tradition in illustrating storytelling, and so putting it in this very simple context of, image-to-image type of animation seemed to work with the style, the context of Diana's life. And it was a way of introducing parts of the story that many of the interviewees were unaware. So there were personal stories that nobody knew except me. There were a lot of people I interviewed were historians like you or descendants of refugees like you also. But a lot of people didn't have detailed information about Diana. And so these animated clips do a couple different things. One, it provides the visual media, which of course you expect in a film, but it also provides a storytelling expression, a media to, to give it, a little more personal side. Instead of just having a talking head or being lectured at, it kind of breaks up the monotony of a documentary.
So the making of this film was about about 6 years in the making, right? From sort of the first idea.
Yeah, or even more. It's been a while. It's taken a good 6 to 8 years. Yes. So because things, they kind of unraveled at different times. So, yeah, everything wasn't available all at once, and the story kind of grew and changed and evolved as time went on.
And it was something that you had to put your own resources into, right? Financially, putting in your own resources to find the people, the directors, the post-production, music, all of that.
Right. It's a filmmaking is very complicated, and there are a lot of components to it. And it's very hard to get fundraising, I have to say. The film was accepted by the San Francisco Film Society, and they gave us nonprofit status. And I did a lot of grant writing to support the film. I have to say that the Gulbenkian Foundation was incredibly supportive, and that actually, their donation was absolutely critical in helping us move forward. But I had also inherited some funds from my uncle, and I decided that I was just going to invest that instead of kind of keeping it for my retirement years. I was just going to splurge and spend that on the film because it just it needed the extra resources, and it was available, so it just enabled me to accomplish what I wanted to.
Yes, the film is called The Stateless Diplomat, Diana Apkar's Heroic Life. It outlines really the extraordinary life of this woman of the diaspora who was born from a family from old Iran, from the Armenian community in Iran, was born in Rangoon, and then ended up in Japan. It's a great story. We're going to take another break and then come back and finish up the story with Mimi Malayan. This is All Things Armenian. Your host, Professor Barlow Dermagradichian. We'll take another brief break with some music from the band Bampish.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
Thank you.
Tune into All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
This is All Things Armenian. I'm your host, Professor Barlow Dermagerdichian. Over our break, we were listening to two Gomidas pieces, modern arrangements of Gomidas, done by the Pampir Armenian Folk Rock Band. A very, very interesting band, I think. I like their music quite a bit. So, again, that's the Pampir Band that we were listening to. My guest today has been Mimi Malayan. She is the great-granddaughter of Diana Apkar. In our first segment, we were talking about the life of Diana Apkar. And in the second segment, we were talking about the production and the making of the movie on Diana Apkar's life called The Stateless Diplomat. Mimi, thank you for being with us today.
Oh, thank you.
And so the movie has been all over the world now. It's kind of exciting. And I'd like you to tell us a little bit about your experience in Armenia, because you were invited to both participate in a film festival and then also some interesting things that happened. And I believe you went, maybe, was it your first time in Armenia? I'm not sure, but...
It wasn't my first time to Armenia, but yes, I did apply to the Golden Apricot Film Festival it screened in July of 2019. I'm getting all confused what year it is. Right, just last summer. And I went to Armenia for that screening. But the film also screened at AUA, the American University of Armenia. And it had another screening at the AGBU building in Yerevan. It was sponsored by IWA, the Armenian Women's Association. And so there was a very positive response to the film, and several people attended. And in fact, the outcome of one of those screenings was a Yerevan City Council member attended the screening in at AUA, and a woman named Diane Melkomian, and has since took it upon herself to write a proposal about Diana to the City Council, and the City Council on October 8th voted and named a prominent park in Yerevan after Diana Apkar. And so now, as of October 8th, there is a prominent park bordered by Sarian Street and Aram Street, Mesrop Mashtot Street. And that is now the Diana Apkar Park. So the next phase will be to build a statue in the park of Diana, and so that she has, so that she can continue to gain the recognition she deserves.
Yeah, I think this is really something that people need to give you a lot of credit for, that through your research and through your persistence, you were able to gather together the materials and put together this film. The film has recently also appeared in Los Angeles at the ARPA Film Festival, and Mimi was telling me it's going to be in Japan. Tell us briefly about what's happening in Japan with the film.
Well, December 1st, it screened at a small women's film festival in Osaka. It will also be screening, however, in June. The Kanagawa University wants to hold a Diana Apkar symposium. There will be lectures, presentation, discussion, and film. It would be an all-day event. The details aren't yet scheduled, but it's being worked on. And so that is very exciting to me, because Japanese people are unaware, really, of Diana, or, I mean, it's, I'm not really sure what her recognition is in Japan.
Right.
So they find it, I think they're impressed, and I'm very pleased that they've taken an interest, and so that there are several things that are starting to happen.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you very much. For those people who are listening and would like to get the film, it is on DVD. At this point, you can get it through contacting Mimi Malayan. If you'd like to, you can contact me, and I'll put you in contact with Mimi to be able to get the DVD. It's well worth it. Thank you, Mimi Malayan, for joining us today on All Things Armenian. Appreciate it.
It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you so much. Just a couple of things coming up just in the community. On February 29th, there's going to be a dinner dance at St. Paul Armenian Church featuring the singer Joseph Krikorian. It's going to be at the Haig Barbarian Hall. It starts at 8 o'clock. If you're interested in tickets, you can contact St. Paul Armenian Church. That's the young people's group called the KEF Group at St. Paul Armenian Church. Let's take another brief break and listen to one more song from the Armenian folk band called Bampir, and when we come back, we'll be concluding this episode.
Zorid nalan nam versierku, jerku man naran, karces herwi, zorid nalan, dalki. Uszartel, mek herwi, zorno. Dernerat zahatsu Gisher nernan zorid nernan verç yerku Kırk nerk maherof akan şahoyu Yerku men naran kılka arces servis Zorid Shashuk naran taparu Yerku man naran Karces harvi sarid naran Darkis Ushartan mek harvi carno Dernerat zahatsu Gisher nernan zorit nernan verç yerku Kırk nerk narof akan şoyu Yerku men naran kulka arces servis Zorit nernan Thank you.
Welcome back to All Things Armenian. I'm Professor Barlo Dermagradichian. Today we're going to be talking now at the last few minutes here just about some of the upcoming events taking place at the Armenian Studies Program. As I mentioned earlier, we are now at the last part of our break, and we're going to be starting classes. On Tuesday, January 28th, we have a very interesting lecture coming up. It's called David Ohanessian and the Armenian Ceramics of Jerusalem. Today in the city of Jerusalem, the Armenian ceramics produced there are famous throughout the world. And our guest on January 28th is Sato Mughalyan, and she will be talking about her grandfather, who was David Ohanessian, and she'll be talking about how the art of making Armenian ceramics came from the old country, from a place called Kutaya in old Armenia, to Jerusalem. That lecture will take place at 7:30 p.m. in the University Business Center, room 191. That's all free events for the Armenian Studies program, this one. And then on Friday, February the 7th, we're going to be having our first lecture by Dr. Ari Shakarian. Dr. Shakarian is going to be the Kazan Visiting Professor in Armenian Studies, and he will be giving three lectures during the semester. And on Friday, February the 7th, he'll give a talk called An Untold Story of Survival, the Armenian Community in Istanbul during the years 1918 to 1923. Once again, that's in the University Business Center, room 191, Alice Peters Auditorium. And then our big event coming up in February will be the benefit concert for the House of Hope Merhuis. That will benefit the House of Hope program based in Armenia. It's a program that helps young women in Armenia who come from disadvantaged families. And so there's going to be a benefit concert, which will be held on Saturday, February the 22nd at 7 p.m. This one does require tickets, and you can call us at the Armenian Studies Program at 559-278-2669 if you would like tickets, so make sure you do that. All of our upcoming events are always available on Facebook, so if you go to Facebook and search for Armenian Studies Fresno State, you'll find all of our events, all of our upcoming events, all the way through April listed for you, or you can go to our website at fresnostate.edu/Armenian Studies, and in that way you'll be able to stay informed about all of our events and about all the things that are happening in the Armenian Studies program. I'm looking forward to the semester. We're going to have a lot of classes, a lot of different lectures, presentations, and also later in April we'll have some films. So a lot of activities, a lot of things. So always tune in to us at All Things Armenian. You'll hear about it every Sunday between 2 and 3 p.m. I'm again your host, Professor Barlo Dermagradichian of the Armenian Studies Program. Thank you for joining us once again on All Things Armenian.
El siguiente es un programa pagado por el anunciante y 1600 AM no se hace responsable por las opiniones reflejadas en su contenido.
This is a special program on Multicultural 1600 AM, so please stay tuned.
Tune in to All Things Armenian, presented by the Armenian Studies Program at California State University, Fresno. Enjoy in-depth conversation on the Armenian culture and learn everything going on in the valley within the Armenian community. Listen every Sunday at 2 p.m. on Multicultural 1600 AM.
KGST, Fresno. La 1600 AM.